This is Sierra Dahl with the Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum. And today we have Scott Sempling, who is an author discussing some issues related to utilities. Scott, why don't you introduce yourself a little bit and tell us a little bit about some of your work.
Thank you. Scott Sempling here, and thanks for attending today. I'm a lawyer in private practice. I have spent the last 35 years fighting utilities, partly to protect consumers, partly to advance consumer empowerment, partly to diversify both the fuel sources and the nature of the types of companies we have. I'm somebody who likes competition when it works and doesn't like it when it doesn't, and I focus on the facts. I don't do faith. I don't do ideology. I don't do prayer. I just focus on facts and logic and try to get things moving where they should be moving. Many of my clients have been regulatory commissions, most recently the Hawaii Commission, the Puerto Rico Commission. Many of my clients also are state consumer advocates. I've done work for the Sierra Club. I teach public utility law at Georgetown Law. I'm working on a book on mergers right now. If I had to describe the singular principle that I pursue in my career, it's that we need to find first, what are the aspects of performance that we want to see in an industry that affects the public? What types of companies?
Conference muted.
What types of companies are most likely to produce that performance? What types of market structures are most likely to attract the companies that will provide that performance? And then what kind of regulatory tools, both statutory and methodological, do we need to have to ensure that performance accords with public interest? So my field is about performance. My discipline is law, but I try to work with economists, finance experts, accountants, engineers, political people, managers, to try to bring together all those disciplines to make things work. So my purpose today is to talk to you about utility resistance to entry into traditional utility industries. And I titled the presentation Utility Resistance to Competition, Sources and Solutions. I'm going to start by making just a few comments about sources because I think the sources are obvious, and then I'll turn to solutions, and I'm going to see if I can keep this to about 15 minutes, then we'll have time to talk. So sources of utility resistance, well, I've put them into three categories. I'm not going to my paper yet. I'm just going to talk extemporaneously for a moment. There are legitimate utility reasons for which I have some sympathy. There are also legitimate utility reasons for which I have some empathy. And then there are illegitimate utility reasons for which I have neither sympathy or empathy. Now, let me explain. Legitimate reasons for which I have sympathy. A utility in most states has had a monopoly, but it has also had a statutory obligation to serve. To carry out that obligation, it's had to invest hundreds of millions, sometimes billions of dollars, in physical plant, distribution, transmission, headquarters building, generation, education of its staff, learning the nature of the consumer base which it serves. Those are legitimate costs that regulators have approved on the assumption that the utility would be a monopoly with an obligation to serve. Now, if suddenly you introduce the new entrants and new opportunities for customers to shop before the utility has recovered all those costs, is what we in the industry call, unfortunately, I don't like the phrase, but we call it stranded cost. Well, there is a legitimate argument on the part of the utility that they incurred these costs subject to an obligation to serve. They ought to recover them before they before new competitors come or somehow over a transition period. I'm going to discuss the law and logic of that issue later, but I wanted to state at the beginning that I'm one of the people in the industry that doesn't demagogue that issue. It's a legitimate concern of the utility, and it needs to be addressed. I didn't say we give them all the dollars. I say it needs to be addressed and taken seriously. Then there's a legitimate point of view of the utilities for which I have empathy. I don't put a sign out on my front yard after 37 years of marriage that says, "My wife is available." Anybody who's got a monopoly over something intends to keep it and doesn't enjoy the opportunities that others might have to take it away. So I have some empathy for a utility that says, gee, I like this business, I like the monopoly, I don't want somebody taking it away. I said I had empathy for that, I don't have sympathy for it, meaning I understand it, but it's not a basis for public policy to perpetuate a monopoly. And we'll discuss in the bulk of this conversation ways to avoid perpetuating that monopoly. And then there's the set of interests the utility has that I think are illegitimate, and so for those I have neither sympathy nor empathy, and that is the business strategy that every utility I know has, which is to take advantage of its existing monopoly to create new monopolies over new products and services. You see it with Microsoft, you see it with Google, you see it with any large company, but it's particularly galling when it's a company that had the job handed to them by the government. They didn't have to pay the government to become the franchisee. They didn't have to win a competition to do it. These are historic franchises that were granted 100 years ago. Nobody can ever say that the company has earned it. They certainly don't have to compete to keep it, and now they're trying to use them to advance that same monopoly into new industries. And while that type of behavior isn't necessarily a violation of antitrust law, we wouldn't necessarily call it anti-competitive behavior technically. It is behavior, it is competition with unearned advantage. I don't use the word unfair because anytime you use the word fair, somebody else says, well, that's not fair to them. But you can use the word unearned advantage and you can calculate whether the advantage is earned or unearned. Is it on the merits or is it because of legacy? Is it because the boss handed it to them, the daddy handed it to them, the mommy handed it to them, and now they want to use it for a new business? That's the type of utility aspiration that certainly is legitimate internally in terms of growth, in terms of shareholder return, but as a public policy, it's not deserving of either sympathy or empathy. Now, the second aspect I wanted to underscore before I move into solutions is, well, it's one thing for a monopoly to have all these predictable attitudes toward its current market share and its desire to grow it. Nobody should be surprised by that. And I've decided, you know, I'm not young anymore, to fight greed is a waste of time. You fight deception. You fight illogic. You fight unearned advantages. You fight unlawful behavior. Forget about fighting greed. We're all greedy. It doesn't work to fight greed. It works to fight the people who have unearned advantages. Now, so no surprise about these three features of the monopoly mindset. The mystery to me, and one that we have to contend with if we're going to be effective in policy and in politics, is why do so many regulators fall for it? I'm in the middle of writing a book on a 30-year trend where, ironically, while we're decentralizing technology and trying to bring new entry into small parts of our industry, the industry is consolidating in electricity. We have fewer than half the number of major utilities than we had just 20 years ago, and regulators seem to be completely indifferent to this notion of consolidation at the same time we're trying to encourage decentralization. And because I spent so much of my time literally at the elbows of regulators, I mean, the problem is my sample is distorted because I tend to work for very good ones, but I also work in front of, as a witness, regulators that are not so good. And because of the intimacy of those relationships, I've begun to develop a pretty good feel for the personality characteristics, the attributes that distinguish effective from ineffective regulators. And I'll just mention a couple of things, and these are inherent in human nature. It's just sad that they seem to come out with such muscularity in the utility field. Well, regulators have a sense of awe of the utilities. And that awe is justified. You flick a switch, smoke goes off 150 miles away, and the lights go on. That's something to be awed by. But that's the technology we're awed by, the engineering. There's no reason to have that awe transferred to their strategy decisions, but that happens. Then there are regulators who think the utility is our only alternative. They've been there for 100 years. They've been there for good reason. There is nobody else we could find to replace them. So this is the one we have to live with. Whatever they ask for, within reason, we're going to give it to them. There's also a problem that we have no history, as we'll learn as I talk further this afternoon. We have no history of actually replacing the incumbent. You know, you just went through an election where a variety of people got replaced. Bye-bye. Somebody's coming in to do a better job. Doesn't matter whether it's on the right or the left. We have every 6 years, every 4 years, every 2 years, we have these elections, opportunities for people to change their mind about who serves them. There's no history of doing that in our business. It could be done commercially. You could lay out a path by which this happens. There is no such path, and no regulator wants to be the one to start it. And then there's plain old careerism. It's kind of hard to find a job after 4 years as a regulator if you want to work in the biz, and you've just spent the last 4 years beating up on the utility. That's not corruption. It's just plain old careerism. So I wanted to start with that first topic to give you a sense of the sources of stickiness in the monopolies. There's legal stickiness that we'll talk about shortly, but there is this political stickiness by which there seems to be a more than a hesitance, even a fear, to confront the incumbent utilities. And that is the context in which people, I assume, on this call and the whole independent sector of the industry is trying to find a way to bring their services to our customers. So let me turn to the actual paper, and I'm not going to discuss all 22 pages. I decided just to focus on the first six or seven. I want people to understand what exactly is this legal structure by which the utility becomes a monopoly, and what are the ways to shake that structure so that it can accommodate stable service and reliably priced service, but also the newcomers that want to bring new products and the newcomers that want to bring new styles of ownership. So let's understand this notion of the incumbent utility franchise. How must it change so that new competitive providers can penetrate historically monopoly product markets? Well, first let's understand exclusivity. Exclusivity means that as a matter of law or fact, there's only one company providing a particular service in a particular territory. How does that happen? Excuse me. It's a matter of state law. States grant these exclusive franchises. Either the legislature or the commission does so. What's an exclusive franchise at retail? It means that the state has defined a geographic area. It's defined a specific set of services. It has prohibited retail competition within that area for those services. It's appointed a particular company to be the sole seller of those services. And we have two poles within this context of exclusivity. I gave you in the paper the South Dakota statute because it embodies the legal, I would say, the supermajority approach legally. And its statute very simply says each electric utility has the exclusive right to provide electric service at retail at each and every location in a particular area, and to each and every, watch this, to each and every present and future customer. Well, that's pretty good. You're a utility executive. You go to sleep and sleep well every night because you've got that exclusive state law-protected franchise for each and every present and future customer. It's interesting. So I've done a lot of work for the Hawaii Commission. The original franchise were granted by the king back in the days when they had a king. And those franchises now by state law are legally and expressly non-exclusive. I've read the documents. It says this is not an exclusive franchise. The fact is, at retail, there is only one utility on each of the islands that serves. So as a matter of history, fact, practice, inertia, habit, there is no alternative to the utility, notwithstanding the non-exclusivity of the franchises. Now, what I've found interesting is I've studied this area as my next subject here, and that's the four types, the four ways in which states have broken the franchise, have breached the exclusivity of the franchise, and gotten newcomers in. Now, you probably can think of examples yourself, and we can have discussions about the feasibility of new ideas, but I want to give you these four essentially legal categories by which states have chosen to allow a breach of the exclusive franchise. And you'll probably be able to think of your own examples within each of these categories. So the first is comes from the state of Maine, where the commission has found, well, let's just start it this way, where a competitor believes that the incumbent is offering an inadequate service or is failing to offer a service that the non-incumbent, the new entrant, is willing and able to provide. And the story here has to do with crappy telephone service. Not the incumbents. The incumbent's telephone service was fine. But along comes the Saco River Company, and it wants to offer crappy service. It wants to offer discounted, intrastate, long-distance telephone service, purchased wholesale from other companies. It's not great. You're going to have to dial. This is years ago. You're going to have to dial extra numbers. You're going to get a scratchy line. Maybe you're going to be proposing marriage, and half the people in town are going to be listening in. But guess what? You get it at a discount. Now, the incumbent utility was not proposing this crappy telephone service, and it opposed the request. Well, why? Because you don't want to have some newcomer coming in, showing you up, and offering a service you're not providing. The commission says, you know what? We're all for it. It turns out that customers want discounted, crappy service. Some people eat at McDonald's. Some people eat at the Ritz. That's the way things go. The company is not providing this as an alternative service. The public interest would be served by customers having a choice. And so the Maine Commission, upheld by the courts in Maine, authorized this newcomer to offer this service in competition with the incumbent. So that's the first category, a type of service that the incumbent is not providing and an opportunity under the statute approved by the commission for a new entrant to provide that service. Second, I think, is one of the areas which is probably closest to the heart of some of the people on the call now. Well, some customers want to serve themselves, either alone or in groups, and they think they can do it more economically and effectively than the incumbent. Now, it could be your own solar panel. It could be a neighborhood microgrid. It could be an industrial park which wants to build its own generator and self-supply and detach from the system, or maybe remain attached for various backup purposes. Now, self-generation is a form of competition. It breaches the exclusive franchise. And because the state is in charge of the exclusive franchise, the decisions about this type of entry, self-generation, always lie with the state. There can be encouragement from Congress, but the ultimate question about whether to allow it is normally at the state level, unless for some reason the federal government, as it did in telecommunications, mandated that there be entry. Anyway, I've put on the next page there, if you have the document in front of you, two contrasting examples of how states have handled this problem of self-generation. In California, they said in the legislature, well, this is a great idea. We want our customers to have opportunities through self-generation for five things: backup power during utility outages, peak demand power when the utility doesn't have enough capacity to serve all its customers, economic power when the self-generator's operating costs are less than the utility's costs, pollution reduction when the self-generator can generate with fewer emissions than the utility, and lastly, for a lot of the new tech companies, what we call power quality enhancement. So California was all for this notion of self-generation, let a thousand flowers bloom, and let's see what happens, and California actually gave incentives for self-generation. Contrasting response is in Massachusetts. They weren't against self-generation, but they were very focused on what I called the stranded investment problem at the outset of our call today. This notion that if you're a customer and you leave because you're self-generating, or you're an industrial park and you leave the utility system, well, you're leaving behind costs that the utility incurred under its obligation to serve. Some other sucker has to pick those up, either the utility shareholders or the utility customers, and you're escaping them. They were built on your behalf. You're leaving them behind. You're now building redundant capacity. There's a risk that redundant capacity is inefficient societally because you're adding things you don't need. And, yeah, it sounds like I'm discouraging competitive entry, but I'm also trying to recognize, if I'm Massachusetts, that there's an issue of what do we do with the costs that have been incurred in the past. We'll have to have more discussion about that in our Q&A session. It's a legitimate point of view, as I indicated at the very outset, but it meant that Massachusetts was far more conservative and touchy about whether to allow self-generation than California was. Well, that's the second category of what I call the breaches of exclusivity. What's the third category? Well, I really enjoy this one. The third category is when, within the range of monopoly services historically provided by the incumbent, within that range, might there be one service that would be better provided by a specialty company. Now, a lot of you probably know this already. Utilities are not big on conservation because they earn their money in part through rates that recover fixed costs through a variable charge. And so when people lower their consumption, they're contributing less to the fixed costs, and the utilities cost recovery and profits go down. And so they're not big on energy conservation. So the states of Maine, Oregon, Hawaii, and Vermont, and I believe other states have followed, all have decided, let's have an exclusive franchise for providing conservation, energy efficiency, demand management services. Let's have competition to appoint that franchisee. Let's take the whole aspect away from the utilities. Let them produce, let them transmit, let them distribute, but let somebody else who actually has their heart and soul and skills in energy conservation carry out that task. So what we've actually done is separate it out from one or more of the utilities' historic jobs, one that we think somebody else can do better. And as I talk to some other people about the distribution space, distribution planning, storage, demand aggregation, et cetera, those, again, may be areas today at the frontier where we may want to appoint somebody other than the utility to manage that whole process. And then the last, Sierra, and then I'll pause, and we'll take some questions and answers. And if there's more time, I'll talk about the law of stranded investment. So the last is what some people call the nuclear bomb. But I wish it was discussed less dramatically because it ought to be more common. And that's when the state, either the legislature or the commission, has become dissatisfied with the incumbent's performance and decides to hold a competition for the opportunity to be the new monopoly. So we're retaining, in this context, we're retaining the notion of some monopoly over some set of services, but like congressional seats, like the presidency, we're asking the question, why not have a competition to see if somebody can do it better? I love this quote from the Court of Appeals. The public has an obvious interest in competition, even though that competition be an elimination bout. Well, that's what we mean by franchise competition, competition for the right to be the monopoly. It's the right to serve all the customers in a given territory for some specific period of time. The sad feature of American utility regulation is that we don't do this. We don't do it at all. The situations where a major utility in the electric field has lost its franchise because of performance, I'm actually aware of only one. It was a company called Citizens Power, and it took decades for commissions eventually to take that franchise away. It's happened with small water companies. Often these very small companies were built in the 40s and 50s, in the just after World War II. They were small neighborhood-type things. The sophistication required to run a water company today is much greater. Some of these companies started to fail. Consolidation was necessary, and some state commissions stepped in and revoked franchises and found new entities to carry out those services. But we've never seen it done in the electric side. And I think the reasons go back to my opening conversation that people think it's infeasible. Of course, utilities fight it. They'll call it socialism, which is ironic because it's the essence of competition. Anyway, that's the opening, Sierra. I've talked about four paths to penetration, four paths to penetration, entering as a competitor and providing a service that the incumbent isn't providing, group self-service or single self-service, providing a unique service on a franchise basis, taking that away from the utility, the Vermont, Oregon, Hawaii, and Maine examples, and lastly, this notion of competition for the franchise. Last thing I'll say before I turn it back to Sierra is this. The way one wants to think about this and talk about this, as I think I said at the outset, this is not about ideology. It's not about religion. It's not about whether you like big government or small government. It's not even whether you're pro-regulation or anti-regulation. All those concepts to me are meaningless. What matters is performance. And so you're asking the question, what are the types of companies that will perform? Of course, you have to define what you want from performance. And then what are the market structures, whether it's monopoly or competition, that will attract those companies? This quote from Alfred Kahn is an excellent way to close this part of the presentation, what Alfred Kahn, who was the great author of the textbook, The Economics of Regulation, he famously wrote that, quote, the central continuing responsibility of legislatures and regulatory commissions is finding the best possible mix of inevitably imperfect regulation and inevitably imperfect competition. That's the way I try to pursue my work. What is the best possible mix of our imperfections? Let's stay humble. Let's stay modest. Let's focus on facts and logic. Let's experiment. Let's see what works. Let's discard what doesn't and advance what does. Sierra, thanks for this opportunity. I'll turn it back over to you now.
All right. Super. I'm going to unmute everybody. Please make sure your phones are on mute so we don't have a lot of background noise, and open it up to comments and questions. Anybody?
Here, I've got a question. It's Larissa.
You want to mute yourself, please, so he knows who it is.
This is Larissa Dobriansky. I'm with General Microgrids, and like I said, I've read a lot of your articles and support, you know, the bottom line that if this is the public interest and it's to serve the consumers, we all should be looking for the most cost-effective solutions. But per what you've raised, I like your reactions to this. You know, we're moving, of course, we have moved into a new era, great uncertainty, great change. And one thing I'll add from my experience, you know, you've mentioned kind of the reluctance, you know, of regulators to be more challenging to utilities. But some of this is shifting. However, there is consternation because there's such asymmetries of information. As you said, there's this rotation, you know, the regulators come in for short periods of time. It's actually hard to take on the utilities when they've got in their possession all the information, and, you know, the regulators don't have that access to it. And the legacy system kind of reinforces this type of asymmetrical positioning between the regulators and the utilities. But now everybody's got to look more forward and to see how to accommodate, assimilate, understand change, and even make reforms that could better really manage the kind of challenges that everybody is facing. So here's the question in that context. You know, you mentioned four opening pathways. They've laid on the books, but not much has happened. But perhaps they can be more tapped into now in this new context of change, and particularly because one very new dimension has been added to these regulatory proceedings, and that is the importance of pilots. A lot of times in the past, decisions had to be made, whether you had all the information or minimal information, and there really was not this kind of more openness to searching out answers and forming decision-making with pilots. How could pilots, and a lot of the jurisdictions are now taking big interest in pilots to inform their decision-making, how could pilots be used in a manner, you know, not just kind of handed over to utilities to frame, but in a manner where there's a process set up and you can get more information, and that information perhaps could bring to the surface, you know, better the needs and whether the utility is in the best position to do things or where the utility is in the best position to do things versus others, or whether even partnerships are the best. Could pilots be used as a means to search out better and bring these pathways to the surface to help actually forge a more constructive future in terms of handling change in the electricity sector?
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed that question very much and learned a lot from it. Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah. There's something that you said right toward the end of your question that nailed it. It's all in the framing. So a pilot can be used and it can be misused. It's all a question of whose pilot it is. What I have noticed is that the pilots tend to be about technology and not about market structure. And if the pilot is about technology, then your information and expertise asymmetry that you referred to is going to carry the day, and the utility is going to be happy to pilot a proceeding on smart grid, a proceeding on utility scale solar, even a proceeding on competitive procurement when the utility will be judging the very race in which it's contesting. So the problem with pilots is if you call it a pilot and what it really ends up being is an opportunity for the utility to show how much more it knows about the subject than everybody else, and an opportunity for the utility to bend the phrasing of the issues and the framing of the questions so that the answers just happen to be, let's stick with the people that we've always had for 100 years. Now all you've done is pilot yourself in a circle and come back to where you started and having to pay for the transportation yourself. So, of course, the idea is sound. We have to be incremental, not just because that's the way politics works, but because that's the way technology works. Nobody's going to win an election saying, I'm going to throw out the utilities. So the key is that the piloting has to be done by the commission. And that gets us back to, without my repeating what you said and what I said, the present incapability of your typical commission. Now, I don't mean the big ones like the New Yorks, the Texases, and the Pennsylvanias, and the Californias, but I do mean largely the other 46 or so commissions are not in a position technically yet to master the subjects so that they can actually frame the question objectively and run the pilot. But that's a quick answer to your question. The key, again, I'm just going to state it so that it just comes home. The pilot has to be not just about technology, but about who does what. And the question has to be put squarely on the table. This is a chance to see if somebody can do this job better than the incumbent. And that's especially the case when it's a job that the incumbent has never done before. I can't tell you how disappointing it was to read through the opening big order from the New York Commission correctly describing this new job of the DSPP, the Distribution System Platform Provider. And the same thing up in Maine, they called it the Smart Grid Coordinator. The idea that we're going to need somebody like the air traffic controller to do all of the planning, all the procuring, all of the managing of the new sources of competitive options that are going to come. And the first thing they do is say to the utility, well, we know that you're going to need more money now, so you get to be as one of the competitors, and we also want to see you be the air traffic controller. So they had the technological analysis right. They had the methodological analysis right. They had all of the right buzzwords about the environment and diversity and technology, and then they blew it by handing the job to the utility. And so that's what I mean by a pilot that will fail because it's testing the wrong question. Back to you, Sierra.
I'm guessing somebody else might have something to say here. Anybody else?
Yeah, this is Jerry Grom. Oh, I'm sorry.
Right. Please introduce yourself.
This is Jerry Braun. I really appreciated both the initial discussion and also your response to Larissa's question. My organization is focused on encouraging collaboration between local jurisdictions and energy utilities. And one simple question. I won't go into all of that, but when you talked about franchising and approving franchises, at least in California, I believe the local jurisdictions that have franchise agreements with the grid owners. And it seems to me that it might be possible for when those agreements come up for renegotiation to target some of the things that you've been talking about in some way, but I don't think typically the local jurisdictions worry about that. I think instead they worry about what the franchise fee will be and how they're going to spend it. And so I would appreciate your comments on, especially if you've ever seen a negotiation of a local city or county franchise agreement that addressed anything other than simply what the fee is.
Thank you. That's just excellent. Now, first of all, it brings me up short. I should have mentioned then a fifth category. When I talked about paths to new entrants becoming a replacement for the utility. And, of course, what you just said, sir, is the fifth option, is when the franchise term comes up for renewal, that's a time to see whether there's somebody else waiting in the wings. Now, I want to give you, again, before I want to answer your question, I want to clarify one point. Like any legal area, the language can become fuzzy among us, and that word franchise can have multiple meanings. Let me distinguish two things so that you and I don't get mixed up, sir. There's the granting of the control of the service territory, which is normally done at the state level, that granting of the exclusive right to serve. And then what's often granted at the municipal level, and often the word franchise is used there as well, it's not the right to serve, it's the right to dig into the streets and lay wires. It's the right to drive a truck and hold up traffic so that you can string lines up. And that's a very different concept. And quite frankly, you wouldn't want to have 500 different municipalities all deciding which utility was going to have the right to serve electricity in that state, in that particular area, because their economies of scale, at least at the distribution level. So you are right, of course, that franchise renewal, depending on how we use that word, could be a fifth path. Now, what's interesting, though, remember the South Dakota statute. Ain't no franchise renewal, right, unless the legislature changes the statute. And what I've learned in this country is that with very few exceptions, these exclusive franchises are granted indefinitely. Now, I happen to know, because I had to write, one of the chapters of my legal book is on this subject, that Nevada grants 50-year terms. Well, I'm 62 years old. I'm not going to be around, you know, when that year 50 comes around. But so many other states don't have any term of years at all. Let me tell you how backwards our country. Are you still there, sir?
I am.
Yeah. So I don't know if anybody here has heard of the nation Vanuatu. It's a small island. It used to be called New Hebrides, and it's about a four-hour plane ride north of Australia. I know about it because the last time I was down to give a talk on Australia, people that I'd met at a conference from the Vanuatu Regulatory Authority invited me to come up and teach a class for a day and a half, and so I did that a couple of years ago. And in the course of preparing for that, I read through the franchise agreements that the Vanuatu Regulatory Authority, that the national government, has entered into with the French conglomerate that supplies, that owns the electric company. And this thing, while it had its problems, was substantially clearer and more progressive than anything I've ever seen in the good old USA. So very quickly, for example, it said, well, here's your franchise, okay, and you have the exclusive right to serve for the next 30 years. Have a good time. Now, first of all, anytime, whenever, we can revoke this franchise, says the government, if we find that your service is dysfunctional. And if we revoke that franchise, we don't have to pay a zip. That was option number one. Option number two, any time in the first 7 years, I think I might not say this completely accurately, but any time in the first 7 years, I don't know how, wait a second. I think any time during the 30 years, we could just decide, even if your service is fine, to get rid of you. Now, if we do, we're going to have to pay you for all the costs that you incurred prudently. That's the stranded investment. And we're also going to have to compensate you for an average of 7 years' profit. So we're going to compensate you for your sunk costs and some portion of your lost profit because you were banking on that. But here's the path, and we can do it. And all I'm saying is, now I might have negotiated a tougher deal on that, but the fact that sitting there on a piece of paper is the possibility that the franchisee could lose his job. That CEO's waking up every day saying, I better do a better job, or otherwise they might get the bright idea of replacing me. So I think those are the answers. I can't remember, sir, if there was an appendage to your question I've ignored. Let me know right now if you would.
Well, there is an appendix, and it really relates to municipalization, and I'm sure you're familiar with that topic. So if you have any additional comments on that, that would be helpful.
Well, I'll just add this. I'll add two points. I helped set up the Puerto Rico Energy Commission and worked for them for really as their lead advisor for 3 years until the new governor finally found out how much the utilities didn't like me and took care of that. But in any event, first of all, my heart and soul and my roots are in public power. The first job I had at a law school was working for the leading law firm that represents public electric power, and I've done work for the American Public Power Association. They're all buddies of mine. All I can tell you from my work in Puerto Rico, Long Island, and other places, look, I've seen the best and the worst on the investor-owned side and on the public side as well. So I'm not an ideologue about this. What I like is diversity. Here's the point I guess I want to make, and I'm repeating an earlier point. The path to municipalization is way too expensive, way too complicated, way too uncertain, way too many opportunities for the utility to gum up the works. It is not franchise competition. It's franchise competition with a big thumb on the scale of the status quo, and the legislature, a state legislature with guts, would change that to make it something we would do, not casually, right, not ideologically, but based on facts, but I would hope more frequently. Back to you, Sierra.
Jared, was that you trying to weigh in here?
Actually, that was Rick. Rick Brown wanting to ask a question.
Sure.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, you know, along the lines, but not exactly the same as municipalization, is the CCA option that, as I'm sure many people here are aware, has just sort of exploded onto the California scene in the last few years, with projections that pretty much the great majority of customers that are currently served and by the incumbent investor-owned utilities will be served by CCAs within the next two or three years. One of the areas, though, that hasn't been talked about much is the fact that these CCAs are in a unique position beyond just providing the electricity, you know, purchase and sale of electricity. They also are well positioned to potentially become aggregators of resources that can then serve as non-wire alternatives that do present, obviously, a significant threat to the profitability of, you know, the traditional investor-owned utilities. I'm just curious as to your thoughts about the CCA movement in general, the efforts that are being exercised by the IOUs to try to slow their growth or hamper their growth through things like PCIA proceedings, and this use of and the positioning of them as potentially providing grid alternatives through the non-wire alternative model.
Thank you. Again, another great question. So I know I think I'm probably about to tick off everybody on the call. I want to answer this. I have a set of thoughts about this, and I've given thought to it. I'm not familiar with the details in California. I know that it's going on. I know that people are doing that, talking about it. Years ago, by the way, it's probably 20 years ago now, Nancy Rader, a great colleague of mine who works for the California Wind Energy Association, she and I co-authored for the American Public Power Association essentially a handbook, a guide on municipal aggregation. It's probably not outdated, but probably a lot of people don't need it anymore. So I want to give you the pros and cons of this, and I guess I want to turn I want to talk politics after I talk the technical, because I'm excited by the potential for diversity and experimentation and release of captivity from the incumbent monopolies, all the things that motivate, sir, the movement you're talking about. I'm very concerned about the risks of opportunism, of people handing to the utilities arguments, and I don't know whether there exists in the movement sufficient discipline to prevent that, to prevent the opportunism and handing arguments to the utilities. Again, I just want to be absolutely clear. I know zippo about the details, and so if I'm saying something inaccurate or unfair, you're welcome to call me on it. But let's put it this way. I'm a pretty traditional fellow. I actually have something called a rake and a broom. And when the leaves come down, and I have a bicycle, and I'm not some, you know, tree hugger type. You know, I like to drink beer and pizza, and I follow sports and everything else. And I like action movies, you know, all that kind of nonsense. But I happen to like my rake and my broom. And I live in a neighborhood that's being destroyed. Now, this neighborhood happens to probably vote 99% Democratic, but they're all climate deniers because they all got their leaf blowers. We have a tragedy of the commons. It is every person for him or herself. You know, I was telling my wife, you know what the rule ought to be? There ought to be a ban on leaf blowers, except you can get an exception if you've got a physical impairment. All right, if you can't rake or you know, if you're 68 years old and you're crippled or unwell, sick, and you can't, of course, then, you know, get one of those noisy things. My point is that the tendency for someone to think of themselves as a victim, right, and then to say they're entitled to their own solution, and then to go do it, and to create an external negative to other people, and you all know on this call what I mean by externalities. Well, let's talk about what the potential for externalities are in California if everybody grows their own. Well, first is the risk of destroying economies of scale. Now, I know that's a utility argument. Now, I'm not trying to make their argument, although they'd be pleased to know I was. What I mean is there are facts out there, and there are certain economies that you give up when you completely decentralize. Now, look, I'm enough of an economist to know that there's static efficiency and dynamic efficiency, and the dynamic can exceed the static loss. I'm all for that. My worry, number one, is that if everybody goes off on their own, we lose economies of scale, so we need to do it in a disciplined process. And the other thing is, if we all go off on our own and leave behind the unrecovered costs, somebody has to bear them. All I'm saying is we need to go forward on that subject with sort of a sense of all the facts, and that's all I'll say, and I'll turn it back to you, sir.
Okay, one second.
Scott, here. This is Samuel Golding.
Oh, hey, Samuel. Okay, go ahead.
Hi, Samuel Golding of Community Choice Partners.
Sir.
Managing Director of Local Power, the consultancy that created Community Choice, and I've been focused on California for 8 years.
I said I'd tick off somebody.
Oh, no, you didn't. You're very diplomatic, very balanced. I just put out an article on LinkedIn that I can forward to everyone, really walking through the evolution of the community choice agency model in California, because I find that almost nobody is familiar with it, and it is completely different than the community choice models used in restructured states. So we actually look more like a competitive form of municipal power agency. We've got 20 agencies. Most of them are joint powers authorities with 10 to 30 governments on the board. They've got formal energy risk management policies. They've got 180 staff so far, which will probably double over the course of the year. So in terms of institutional capacity and understanding what they're doing and achieving an economy of scale, we've been very focused on that from the beginning. And it's leading into a discussion of forming a kind of a so-called super agency, kind of like the dominant model in the broader public power sector, like Northern California Power Agency, where smaller utilities get together, pool their resources, and share staff and services across very large territories in aggregate. So I'd encourage you to read that. I do have a question for you about California, which you don't need to be familiar with CCA operations to answer. Rick mentioned this, 40% of customers are transitioning to these community choice agencies by the middle of 2019, and it's causing all sorts of regulatory rule changes, as you'd expect. Now, the problem is, and I'm really curious if you've been picking up on this, it's a bit awkward to say, but the regulatory commission has become very politicized in how it represents technical issues to elected officials. And I'll give you just one example. They have capacity procurement rules, which cause double procurement of capacity and between CCAs and utilities. And there was a very simple fix that they just never implemented for 8 years running. And it got so severe last year that it caused liquidity and gaming issues So there wasn't any, all the capacity was being procured, and in fact, more than enough capacity. And so they were wasting a lot of ratepayer money, not just community choice customer funds, but bundled service customer funds as well. And instead of implementing that simple fix, which would have kind of made them admit that it was their problem, they did the exact opposite. They sent letters to the legislature and emails to, you know, elected officials, mayors in cities studying community choice, claiming that community choice agencies weren't following all the resource adequacy rules, which was factually inaccurate. They were. And also claiming that this might cause another energy crisis with rolling blackouts. And again, the problem was double procurement of capacity, which is kind of the opposite problem from rolling blackouts. And they used this confusion that they created and this fear to push through a resolution on a very tight timeline, which froze the formation of new community choice programs and put them onto this arbitrary launch schedule, you know, pushing out to 2020 and 2021. And so my question for you is, are you following the behavior of the California PUC? Does this sort of politicized behavior occur elsewhere? And what do we all do when there really is no technical, you know, honest discussion or middle ground to resolve these issues?
Yeah, I'm afraid I have zero facts. What you told me is completely new to me. All I knew is that things weren't going well, so I don't want to chew up time guessing at the problem. I will tell you that I mean, it's interesting. I've worked a lot for commissions, and putting aside the merits or lack of merits of what they're saying, I tend to applaud a commission that gets its hands dirty in a political battle as long as it's factual and contributory and plays the role of the parent who is the most respected steward of fact, process, and logic. I frankly see too many commissions who abandon the appropriate political role of being the intellectual leader and leaving them to be the recipient of whatever sausage, actually this may be insulting to the sausage makers, sausage out of the legislature. So I guess what I want to say is I'm sorry that the perception on your part is that what they're doing isn't helpful, and I hope you can turn it around. But that, any more that I would say would just be not useful to you. Back to you, Sierra.
There,
hi, Sierra.
This
is Bear.
Yeah,
yeah.
I knew you'd be there somewhere.
Yeah, no, I'm lurking. Thanks. This has been a great presentation, by the way. And I've spent a lifetime in project finance as well as energy regulation, so I'm very the concession model that you're advocating is very familiar and appealing. I don't know whether you think we're likely to get there, but supposing for the moment that we're not, or just that there are other things on the table, the discussion about DSPPs and so forth, and if we can get a commission that really is a neutral arbiter, as we would hope, you haven't said anything about decoupling and incentive rate making and whether we can, teach utilities new tricks, you know, to be the steward of the marketplace and be happy with being paid for that as opposed to being, you know, the infrastructure. And I'm interested in your comments on that.
Thank you again. So what's fascinating about your question, and I'm going to say something that, again, may be controversial and controverted by some of you, but I want to say it in a way that's clear. What's fascinating about your question is that as soon as we turn to the question of rate making, whether we call it decoupling or so-called performance-based rate making or old-fashioned cost-based rate making, what's important about your question is that we have now changed the subject that I started with. The subject I started with was, how do we adjust market structure to accommodate the diversity and innovation and discipline that we want to see in the provision of the services we need? My focus was on market structure. When we turn to issues like rate making and decoupling, what we're saying is, let's take the subject of market structure off the table. Let's assume for the moment that we're going to continue the status quo of the last century of a monopoly, and how do we establish compensation policies that align the monopoly's practices with our public interest vision. Now, I'll be pleased to give some very brief thoughts. I've got obviously more than a...
Well, can I stop you, though, and say that was not the intention of my question at all? Because I happen to represent something called the Microgrid Resources Coalition, and I've just written an article called Finance at the Grid Edge, which argues we need more independent ability for actors at the grid edge, both customers and communities. So that's my bias, if you will. The question is, can we relegate, rather than do away with the utilities, can we relegate them to managing the transmission system and the distribution system wherever they can't procure a better alternative, and let them do that? And is that a viable way forward from your point of view?
Well, thank you. So I want to put all our thoughts together. So I do understand your question. I am going to stick to my guns in one respect. People on the call should be, now it wasn't this gentleman's intention, but do know when an awful lot of people out there, and some of my best friends do it, when they start turning to rate structure, what it means is that they've given up on the market structure question, and just beware of this. Now, as I understand this gentleman's question, and I applaud it, it's really this. To the extent we have answered the market structure questions, and we have identified those products and services for which we want to have competition, and we found a way through expertise and legal change and political change to break through the inertia, bad habits, and historic monopoly to start down the path toward that market structure, what do we do about the remaining set of services that still must be provided by the monopoly? That's the way I'm interpreting the question, and I think it remains an excellent question, and I've given a great deal of thought to it. So a couple of very quick thoughts, because I've written much more on this, and also there's people that know it better. There's two things that I would say about this question of how do we go about let's phrase it this way. How do we develop compensation policies that ensure that the service that still must be provided by a monopoly is provided cost effectively, objectively, without bias in one direction or another? So maybe a four-part answer. First, I maintain that we still must have a competition for the right to be that monopoly. That was the New York mistake. They may do a good job of identifying what remains of the monopoly service, but handing it to the incumbent rather than having competition for that right, well, I've said my piece on that already, but that's step number one. Step number two, regulators should not do bribes. If you find yourself using the word incentive or incentivize, you've already slipped into the mud, because when you have a utility, whatever it is, a new utility or the old utility, and you have defined an obligation, you don't incentivize. You compensate for the reasonable cost and reasonable profit necessary for that obligation. You don't incentivize. You don't say, would you please do this if I give you something? You say, I have hired you as the monopoly to do this. Let me know your prudent costs. Let me figure out what the reasonable profit rate is, and that is what I will give you, and that is it. We do not incentivize. We compensate. And I can't tell you the number of utilities that abuse the English language, and they cause everybody in the room to say the same words, and all of a sudden incentives are not, if you don't do that, I'm going to kick your butt for $10 a minute. its incentives is always the positive side. So that's the second thing. The third thing is we have to be ready for the situations when the compensation doesn't produce the performance. Okay? Hasn't anybody ever fired a home contractor? Hasn't anybody ever fired a doctor or a dentist or a music teacher because they just weren't competent? If you don't have a plan B, if you don't have the person waiting in the wings who will take the place of the person you've been compensating but they don't perform, then you're just another captive. And I can't tell you, it's again, that's the Vanuatu situation. They've got a great concession agreement, but most people in the world don't even know where the heck Vanuatu is. So they're not exactly going to bid on a chance to go all the way the heck out there. The weather's nice, but the sidewalks stink, okay? It's a little hard to work out there. What I'm saying is if you don't have the ability to replace who's there, then you won't be compensating. You'll be bribing. And so I guess those are my thoughts. Other than that, sir, the answer would be a series of, you know, there's a lot of work already written on technical ways to induce performance. I'm not big on so-called performance-based rate making. Utilities tend to turn that into automatic payment. My question is never how much does the utility want. My question is always what should it cost to provide this service? Back to you, Sierra.
Well, it's actually a little after the hour, so we're going to call it right now, and unless somebody else has a question they have to ask. All right. Okay, super. Scott, that was an excellent presentation. I'm sure everybody really appreciated it. And I really seriously do not think too many of the people in this group that you're talking to disagree with a lot of what you said. They're pretty much pragmatists. So I think they appreciated your feedback for sure. And,
well, Sierra, I want to thank you for the chance. And I'm very it was very inspiring to get the questions from such a dedicated group of people. And so I appreciate this very much, and I'm glad you're doing the work you're doing, Sierra.
Okay, thank you for that. All right, guys, we'll see you next time, and I'll be sending out an email in another day or so about the next conference call, and we have a presentation or webinar coming up on the 20th, I believe it is, and you also should be getting some information about that. So we'll talk to you soon, though. Thanks again.
Thanks, Scott.